Valhalla Rising by Clive Cussler. Copyright 2001 by Sandecker, RLLP. This full-length reading was published by arrangement with G.P. Putnam Sons, a division of Penguin Putnam Incorporated, and was produced in 2001 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. This book has 544 pages and is read by Scott Brick. Should you have any questions about this recording, please call the customer service number shown on the package for information or assistance. Dedication. I'm enormously grateful to Penn Store, Gloria Farley, Richard DeRosset, Tim Firm, U.S. Submarines, and my local fire department for their guidance and expertise. Into Oblivion. June 1035, somewhere in North America. They moved through the morning mist like ghosts, silent and eerie in phantom ships. Tall serpentine prows arched gracefully on bow and stern, crowned with intricately carved dragons, teeth bared menacingly in a growl as if their eyes were piercing the vapor in search of victims. Meant to incite fear into the crew's enemies, the dragons were also believed to be protection against the evil spirits that lived in the sea. The little band of immigrants had come across a hostile sea in long, elegantly shaped black hulls that skimmed the waves with the ease and stability of trout in a peaceful brook. Long oars reached from holes in the hulls and dipped into the dark water, pulling the ships through the waves. Their square, red and white striped sails hung limp in the listless air. Small lapstrake boats, 20 feet long and carrying extra cargo, were tied to the sterns and towed behind. These people were the precursors of those who would come much later. Men, women, and children, along with their meager possessions, including livestock. Of the paths Norsemen had blazed across the oceans, none was more dangerous than the great voyage across the North Atlantic. Despite the perils of the unknown, they'd boldly sailed through the ice floes, struggled under the gale-force winds, fought monstrous waves, and endured vicious storms that surged out of the southwest. Most had survived, but the sea had exacted its cost. Two of the 8 ships that had set out from Norway were lost and never seen again. Finally, the storm-worn colonists reached the west coast of Newfoundland, but instead of landing at Lons O'Meadows, the site of Leif Erikson's earlier settlement, they were determined to explore farther south in the hope of finding a warmer climate for their new colony. After skirting a very large island, they steered a southwesterly course until they reached a long arm of land that curved northward from the mainland. Continuing around 2 lower islands, they sailed for another 2 days past a vast, white sandy beach, a great source of wonder to people who had lived all their lives on unending coastlines of jagged rock. Rounding the tip of the seemingly unending stretch of sand, they encountered a wide bay. Without hesitation, the little fleet of ships entered the calmer waters and sailed west, helped along by an incoming tide. A fog bank rolled over them, casting a damp blanket of moisture over the water. Later in the day, the sun became a dim orange ball as it began to set over an unseen western horizon. A conference was shouted among the commanders of the ships, and it was agreed to anchor until morning, in hopes the fog would lift. When first light came, the fog had been replaced with a light mist, and it could be seen that the bay narrowed into a fjord that flowed into the sea. Setting out the oars, the men rowed into the current as their women and children stared quietly at the high palisades that emerged from the dying mist on the west bank of the river, rising ominously above the masts of the ships. What seemed to them to be incredibly giant trees forested the rolling land behind the crest. Though they saw no sign of life, they suspected they were being watched by human eyes hidden among the trees. Every time they had come ashore for water, they had been harassed by the Skraelings, their term for any foreign-born natives that lived in the alien country they hoped to colonize. The Skraelings had not proven friendly, and on more than one occasion had unleashed clouds of arrows against the ships. Keeping their usual warlike nature under firm control, the expedition leader, Bjarn Sigvardsson, had not allowed his warriors to fight back. He knew well that other colonists from Vinland and Greenland had been plagued by the Skraelings, too, a situation caused by the Vikings who had murdered several of the innocent inhabitants purely out of a barbaric love of killing. This trip, Sigvardsson would demand that the native inhabitants be treated in a friendly manner. He felt it vital for the survival of the colony to trade cheap goods for furs and other necessities without the bloodshed. And unlike Thorfinn Karlsefni and Leif Erikson, whose earlier expeditions were eventually driven off by the Skraelings, this one was armed to the teeth by men who were blood-hardened Norwegian veterans of many battles with their arch-enemies, the Saxons. Swords slung over their shoulders, one hand clutching a long spear, the other a huge axe, they were the finest fighting men of their time. The incoming tide could be felt far up the river and helped the rowers make headway into the current, which was mild due to the low gradient. The river's mouth was only 3/4 of a mile wide, but it soon broadened to almost 2 miles. The land on the sloping shore to the east was green with lush vegetation. Sigvardsson, who was standing with his arm around the great dragon prow of the lead ship, gazing through the dying mist into the distance, pointed to a shadow in the steep rock palisades looming around a slight bend. "Pull toward the left bank," he ordered the rowers. "There looks to be an opening in the cliffs where we can shelter for the night." As they drew closer, the dark, forbidding entrance of a flooded cavern grew in size until it broadened wide enough for a ship to enter. Sigvardsson peered into the gloomy interior and saw that the passage traveled deep under the sheer walls of the cliff. He ordered the other ships to drift while the mast on his ship was unstepped and laid flat to permit entry beneath the low arch at the cavern's mouth. The fjord's stream swirled around the entrance, but the hardy rowers easily drove the ship inside, shipping the oars only slightly to keep them from striking the flanks of the opening. As they passed through, the women and children leaned over the bulwarks and stared down through water of startling clarity, schools of fish clearly visible swimming over the rocky bottom nearly 50 feet below. It was with no little trepidation that they found themselves in a high-ceilinged grotto, easily large enough to hold a fleet of ships 3 times the size of the little Viking fleet. Though their ancestors had embraced Christianity, old pagan traditions died hard. Naturally formed grottos were regarded as the dwelling places of the gods. The walls on the interior of the grotto, formed by the cooling of molten rock 200,000 million years earlier, had been sculpted and worn smooth by the waves of an ancient sea against the volcanic rock layers that were an extension of nearby mountains. They arched upward into a domed ceiling that was bare of moss or hanging growth. Surprisingly, it was also free of bats. The chamber was mostly dry. The water level stopped at a ledge that ascended 3 feet and stretched into the inner reaches of the cavern for a distance of nearly 200 feet. Sigvardsson shouted through the grotto entrance for the other ships to follow. Then his rowers eased off their strokes and let the ship drift until its stem post bumped lightly against the edge of the second cavern's floor. As the other ships approached the landing, long gangplanks were run out and everyone scurried onto dry land, happy to stretch their legs for the first time in days. The foremost matter of business was to serve the first hot meal they'd eaten since an earlier landing hundreds of miles to the north. The children spread out throughout the caverns to gather driftwood, running along the shelves that eons of water erosion had carved in the rock. Soon the women had fires going and were baking bread while cooking porridge and fish stew in large iron pots. Some of the men began repairing the wear and tear on the ships from the rugged voyage, while others threw out nets and caught schools of fish teeming in the fjord. The women were only too happy to find such comfortable shelter from the elements. The men, on the other hand, were big, tousle-haired outdoorsmen and sailors who found it unpleasant to exist in rock-bound confinement. After eating, and just before settling in for the night in their leather sleeping bags, two of Sigvardsson's young children, an 11-year-old boy and 10-year-old girl, came running up to him, shouting excitedly. They grabbed his big hands and began dragging him into the deepest part of the cavern. Lighting torches, they led him into a long tunnel, barely large enough to stand in. It was a tube passage, a rounded cave system originally formed when underwater. After climbing over and around fallen rock, they ascended upward for 200 feet. Then the children stopped and motioned to a small crevice.
"Father, look, look," cried the girl. "There is a hole leading outside. You can see the stars."
Sigvatsson saw that the hole was too small and narrow even for the children to crawl through, but he could clearly see the nighttime sky. The next day he put several men to work, smoothing the tunnel floor to ease access and widening the exit hole. When the opening was expanded so a man could walk through while standing straight, they found themselves stepping into a large meadow bordered by stout trees. No barren, Greenland, timberless land here. The supply of lumber to build houses was limitless. The ground was thick with wildflowers and grass to graze their livestock. It was on this generous land, high above the beautiful blue fjord, bountiful with fish, that Sigvatsson would build his colony. The gods had shown the way to the children, who led the grown-ups to what they all hoped was their newly found paradise. The Norsemen had a lust for life. They worked hard, lived hard, and they died hard. The sea was their element. To them, a man without a boat was a man in chains. Though feared throughout the Middle Ages for their barbarian instincts, they reshaped Europe. The hardy immigrants fought and settled in Russia, Spain, and France, and became merchants and mercenaries, renowned for their courage and ability with the sword and battle axe. Rolf the Ganji won Normandy, which was named after the Norsemen. His descendant William conquered England. Bjarn Sigvatsson was the image of a golden Viking. His hair was blonde with a beard to match. He was not a tall man, but broad in the shoulders with the strength of an ox. Bjarn was born in 980 on his father's farm in Norway, and like most young Viking men, grew up with a restless yearning to see what was over the next horizon. Inquisitive and bold, yet deliberate, he joined expeditions that raided Ireland when he was only 15. By the time he was 20, Bjarn was a battle-ripened, seaborne raider with enough pillaged treasure to build a fine ship and mount his own raiding expeditions. He married Freydis, a sturdy, self-reliant beauty with long golden hair and blue eyes. It was a fortunate match. They blended together like sun and sky. After amassing a vast fortune from plundering towns and villages up and down Britain and sporting numerous scars from battle, Bjarn retired from raiding and became a merchant, trading in amber, the diamond of its time. But after a few years, he became restless, especially after hearing the sagas about the epic explorations of Eric the Red and his son Leif Erikson. The lure of strange lands far to the west beckoned, and he became determined to mount his own voyage into the unknown to found a colony. He soon put together a fleet of 10 ships to carry 350 people with their families, livestock, and farming tools. One ship alone was loaded with Bjarn's fortune in amber and plundered treasure, to be used for future exchange with ships transporting goods from Norway and Iceland. The cavern made an ideal boat and storage house as well as a fortress against any attack by the Skraelings. The sleek craft were pulled from the water onto trees cut into rollers and placed in hewn cradles on the hard rock shelf. The Vikings constructed beautiful ships that were the marvel of their age. They were not only incredibly efficient sailing machines, but also masterworks of sculpture, magnificently proportioned and lavishly decorated with elaborate carvings on stem and stern. Few vessels before or since have matched their lines for pure elegance. The longship was the vessel used for raiding around Europe. She was extremely fast and versatile, with ports for 50 oars. But it was the Knarr that was the workhorse of the Viking explorers.
50 to 60 feet long with a broad 15-foot beam. The Gnar could carry 15 tons of cargo over great distances at sea. She relied mostly on her big, square sail for the open sea, but mounted as many as 10 oars for cruising in shallow water near shorelines. Her fore and aft decks were planked with a spacious open deck amidships that could be loaded with cargo or livestock. The crew and passengers suffered in the open, protected only by ox hides. There were no special quarters for chieftains, such as Sigvatsson. Vikings sailed as ordinary seamen, all equal to one another, their leader assuming command for important decisions. The Gnar was at home in rough seas. Under gale winds and towering swells, she could barrel through the worst the gods could throw at her and still plunge ahead at 5 to 7 knots, covering over 150 miles a day. Built of sturdy oak by superb Viking shipwrights who shaped by hand and eye and used only axes to work the wood, the keel was cut from a single piece of oak into a T-shaped beam that increased stabilization in heavy seas. Next came oak planks that were hewn into thin strakes running with the grain and which curved gracefully before being joined at the stern and stem posts. Known as a clinker-type hull, the planks above overlapped the ones below. Then they were caulked with tarred hair from the animals. Except for the crossbeams that braced the hull and supported the decks, there wasn't another piece of wood on the ship that lay in a straight line. The whole thing looked too fragile for the storms that swept the North Atlantic, but there was a method to the seeming madness. The keel could flex and the hull warp, enabling the ship to glide effortlessly with less resistance from the water, making her the most stable ship of the middle centuries. And her shallow draft allowed her to slip over huge waves like a shingle. The rudder was also a masterwork of engineering. A stout steering oar attached to the starboard quarter, its vertical shaft was turned by the helmsman using a horizontal tiller. The rudder was always mounted on the right side of the hull and was called a stjornbordi. The word came to mean starboard. The helmsman kept one eye on the sea and the other on a bronze, intricately designed weather vane that was mounted on either the stem post or mast. By studying the whims of the wind, he could steer the most favorable tack. A large oak block served as the keelson where the foot of the mast was set. The mast measured 30 feet tall and held a sail that spread nearly 1,200 square feet, cut in a rectangle only slightly wider than a square. The sails were woven from coarse wool in 2 layers for added strength. Then they were dyed in shades of red and white, usually in designs of simple stripes or diamonds. Not only were the Vikings master shipbuilders and sailors, they were exceptional navigators as well. They were born with a genius for seamanship. A Viking could read the currents, the clouds, the water temperature, wind, and waves. He studied the migrations of fish and birds. At night, he steered by the stars. During the day, he used a sun shadow board, a disc-like sundial with a center shaft that was slipped up and down to measure the sun's declination by tracing its shadow on notched lines on the board's surface. Viking latitude calculations were amazingly accurate. It wasn't often that a Viking ship became hopelessly lost. Their mastery of the sea was complete and never challenged. In the following months, the colonists built thick wooden longhouses with massive beams to support a sod roof. They raised a great communal hall with a huge hearth for cooking and socializing that also served for storage and as a livestock shelter. Hungry for rich land, the Norsemen wasted no time in planting crops. They harvested berries and netted fish in great abundance from the fjord. The Skraelings proved curious yet reasonably friendly. Trinkets, cloth, and cow's milk were traded for valuable furs and game. Sigvatsson wisely ordered his men to keep their metal swords, axes, and spears out of sight. The Skraelings possessed the bow and arrow, but their hand weapons were still crudely made of stone. Sigvatsson correctly took it for granted that before long the Norsemen's superior weapons would either be stolen or demanded in trade. By fall,
they were fully prepared for a harsh winter. But this year the weather was mild, with little snow and few frigid days. The settlers marveled at the sunny days that were longer than they'd been used to in Norway, and during their short stay in Iceland. With spring, Sigvatsson prepared to send out a large scouting expedition to explore the new and strange land. He chose to remain behind to assume the duties and responsibilities of running the now thriving little community. He picked his younger brother, Magnus, to lead the expedition. 100 men were selected by Sigvatsson for the journey he expected would be long and arduous. After weeks of preparation, sails were raised on 6 of the smallest boats, while the men, women, and children who remained behind waved farewell to the little armada as it set off up the river to find its headwaters. What was to have been a 2-month scouting expedition, however, turned into an epic journey of 14 months. Sailing and rowing, except when they had to haul their boats overland to the next waterway, the men traveled on wide rivers and across enormous lakes that seemed as vast as the Great Northern Sea. They sailed on a river that was far larger than any of them had seen in Europe or around the Mediterranean. 300 miles down the great waterway, they came ashore and camped in a thickly wooded forest. Here they covered and hid the boats. Then they launched a year-long trek through rolling hills and endless grasslands. The Norsemen found strange animals they'd never seen before. Small dog-like creatures that howled in the night. Large cats with short tails and huge furry beasts with horns and enormous heads. These they killed with spears and found the flesh as delectable as beef. Because they did not linger in one place, the Skraelings did not consider them a threat and cause no trouble. The explorers were fascinated and amused by the differences in the Skraeling tribes. Some stood proudly and possessed noble bearing, but others looked little better than filthy animals. Many months later, they came to a halt when they saw the peaks of enormous mountains rising in the distance. In awe of the great land that seemed to go on forever, they decided it was time to turn back and reach the colony before the first snows of winter. But when the weary travelers finally reached the settlement in midsummer, expecting a joyous welcome, they found only devastation and tragedy. The entire colony had been burned to the ground, and all that was left of their comrades, wives, and children were scattered bones. What terrible friction had caused the Skraelings to go on a rampage and slaughter the Vikings? What had caused the break of peaceful relations? There were no answers from the dead. Magnus and the enraged and grieving surviving Norsemen discovered that the opening to the tunnel leading down to the cavern where the ships were stored had been covered over with rocks and brush by the late inhabitants and hidden from the Skraelings. Somehow the settlers had managed to hide the treasures and sacred relics Sigvatsson had plundered in his younger days, along with their most cherished personal possessions, concealing them in the ships during the Skraelings' attack. The anguished warriors might have turned their backs on the carnage and sailed away, but it was not in their genes. They lusted for revenge, knowing it would most likely end in death. But to a Viking, dying while fighting an enemy was a spiritual and glorious death. And then there was the terrible possibility that their wives and daughters might have been carried away as slaves by the Skraelings. Wild with grief and rage, they collected the remains of their friends and families and carried them down the tunnel to the cavern, where they placed them in the ships. It was part of their traditional ceremony to send the dead to a glorious hereafter in Valhalla. They identified the mutilated remains of Bjarn Sigvatsson and laid him in his ship, wrapping him in a cloak and surrounding his body with the remains of his 2 children and his treasures from life, and buckets of food for the journey. They longed to place his wife, Freydis, beside him, but her body could not be found, nor were there any livestock left to sacrifice. All had been taken by the Skraelings. Traditionally, the ships and their dead would have been buried, but that was not possible. They feared that the Skraelings would dig up and plunder the dead. So the saddened warriors hammered and chiseled at a huge rock above the grotto's entrance, until it dropped in a massive spill along with tons of smaller boulders, effectively sealing off the cavern from the surface of the river. The rock jammed together in a chute several feet below the waterline, leaving a large, unseen opening underwater. The ceremony completed, the Norsemen prepared themselves for battle. Honor and courage were qualities they held sacred. They were in a state of euphoria, knowing they would soon see battle. Deep within their souls, they had longed for combat, the clash of arms, the smell of blood. It was part of their culture, and they had grown up and were trained by their fathers to be warriors, expert in the art of killing. They sharpened their long swords and battle axes that were forged from fine steel by German craftsmen, treasured objects, highly prized and worshipped. Both sword and axe were given names, as if they lived and breathed. They donned their magnificent chainmail shirts to protect their upper bodies and their simple conical helmets, some with nose pieces but none with horns. They took up their shields made of wood painted in bright colors, a large metal rivet in the front attached to arm straps in the rear. All carried spears with extremely long, sharp points. Some wielded broad, double-edged swords 3 feet in length, while others preferred the big battle axe. When ready, Magnus Sigvatsson led his force of 100 Vikings toward the large village of the Skraelings, 3 miles distant from the horrible massacre. The village was actually more of a primitive city containing hundreds of huts housing nearly 2,000 Skraelings. There was no attempt at guile or stealth. The Vikings stormed out of the trees, howling like mad dogs, and rushed through the short stake fence that surrounded the village, built more to keep animals out than attacking humans. The smashing onset wrought great havoc among the Skraelings, who stood stunned and were cut down like cattle. Nearly 200 were slaughtered by the ferocious savagery of the unexpected assault before they could grasp what was happening. Quickly, in groups of 5 and 10 men, they began to fight back. Though they were familiar with the spear and had formed crude stone axes, their favorite weapon of war was the bow and arrow, and soon a hail of arrows filled the sky. The women joined in the chaos, throwing a shower of stones that did little but dent the Vikings' helmets and shields. Magnus charged ahead of his warriors, fighting two-handed with spear in one hand, gigantic battle axe in the other, both drenched and dripping crimson. He was what the Vikings called a berserker, a word that would pass down the centuries as berserk, a seemingly crazed man intent on striking terror in the minds of his enemies. He shrieked like a maniac as he hurled himself at the Skraelings, felling many with his flailing axe. The brutal ferocity overawed the Skraelings. Those who tried to fight the Norsemen hand to hand were beaten off with terrible casualties. Though they were decimated, however, their numbers never diminished. Runners scattered to nearby villages and soon returned with reinforcements, and the Skraelings fell back to regroup as their losses were replaced. In the first hour, the Avengers had worked their deadly way through the village, searching for any sign of their women, but none could be found. Only bits and pieces of cloth from their dresses, worn as adornment by the Skraeling women, were ferreted out. Beyond wrath, there is rage, and beyond rage is hysteria. In a frenzy, the Vikings assumed that their women had been cannibalized, and their fury turned to ice-cold madness. They did not know that the 5 women who had survived the slaughter at the settlement had not been harmed, but passed on to chiefs of other villages as tribute. Instead, their ferocity mushroomed and the earth inside the Skraeling village became soaked in blood. But still, the Skraeling replacements kept coming, and eventually, the tide began to turn. Overwhelmingly outnumbered and severely weakened from wounds and exhaustion, the Vikings were whittled down until only 10 were still left standing around Magnus Sigvatsson. The Skraelings no longer made frontal assaults against the deadly swords and axes. They no longer feared the Norsemen's spears that had been either thrown or shattered. A growing army, now outnumbering the dwindling Vikings by 50-1, stood out of range and shot great flights of arrows into the small cluster of survivors, who crouched under their shields as the arrows struck and protruded like quills from a porcupine. Still the Vikings fought on, attacking, ever attacking. Then the Skraelings rose up as one, and with reckless abandon smashed against the Viking shields. The great tide engulfed the small band of Norsemen and swirled around the warriors making their final stand. The few who were left stood back to back and fought to the brutal end, enduring an avalanche of vicious blows by hatchets made of stone, until they could endure no more. Their last thoughts were of their lost loved ones, and the glorious death that was waiting. To a man they perished, sword and axe in hand. Magnus Sigvatsson was the last to fall, his death the most tragic. He died as the last hope for colonizing North America for the next 500 years, and he left a legacy that would dearly cost those who would eventually follow. Before the sun fell, all 100 of the brave Norsemen found death, along with more than 1,000 Skraeling men, women, and children they had slaughtered. In a most horrible manner, the Skraelings had come to recognize that the white-skinned strangers from across the sea were a marauding threat that could only be stopped by savage force. A pall of shock spread over the Skraeling nations. No blood battle between tribes had ever matched the pure, ghastly death toll, nor the horrible wounds and mutilation. The great battle was only an ancient prelude to the horrendous wars that were yet to come. To the Vikings living in Iceland and Norway, the fate of Bjarn Sigvatsson's colony became a mystery. No one was left alive to tell their story, and no other immigrant explorers followed in their path across the truculent seas. The colonists became a forgotten footnote in the sagas passed down through the ages.